Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
To err is human, to forgive divine, but more important than forgiveness is the ability to learn from our mistakes, including when it comes to design. In his new book, To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure, Duke University professor Henry Petrosky examines engineering catastrophes from the Challenger space shuttle to the Deepwater Horizon oil leak and looks at how we can learn from them. He joins us now. Welcome back to WNYC, Professor Petrosky. Hello.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
And structural design failures plague us all the time. There was just the crane collapse at the number 7 line expansion construction just last week, and it killed a man. What's wrong with the way we look at those kinds of design failures now?
Well, unfortunately, this will probably not be news next week or two. We forget all too quickly about the lessons that can be learned from these failures. I actually have a chapter in my book about crane accidents, and it's interesting that so many of them can be traced to human error, operator error, people trying to overcome the limitations of the machinery, and that's what my book is basically about, is the interaction between human beings and the technology.
And you include the high-profile 2008 crane accidents here in New York. We don't know what happened in the case of the number 7 subway line expansion yet last week, but we do know that the crane was due for an inspection that was not fully completed, and the same inspector had even been the last person to look at one of the cranes that then collapsed in 2008. That's not to say that it's his fault necessarily, but I guess even the best designs can't predict the compromising mistakes that human beings make.
That's exactly right. That's one of the most difficult challenges facing designers. The role of the engineer, the designer, is to really anticipate what could go wrong. But there was one person who once said that the goal is to make designs foolproof. But then he thought, well, but we can't make them damn foolproof. And it's the damn fools that sometimes try to get around the system that really are undermining so much of what is well-intended.
You say foolproof. That is part of the engineer's job, right? You can't completely account for human error, but you have to design for a certain assumption of human error.
Well, that's right. For example, in these large cranes, construction cranes, there are limit switches that keep them from reaching over too far, for example, because there are limits to how far the crane can really reach. But it's widely known that crane operators figure out ways to overcome those limits, and they lock the switches or turn the switches off. This, of course, defeats the whole purpose of the design, and it's very unfortunate, but it is done.
You wrote about failure and design in your first book, To Engineer is Human. That was way back in 1985. Has your view of failure changed since then?
No, not basically. I still believe the subtitle of that book, which was The Role of Failure in Successful Design, and fundamentally, if we don't keep failure in mind, we're not going to succeed. The job of the designer is really to anticipate what can go wrong as far as humanly possible and design against it. In this new book, I try to broaden my view to look more about the human factor, the operator, the inspector, and so forth, because so many accidents seem to be attributable to that.
And do we learn from our failures? For example, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill from 2010 has been back in the news, with BP reaching an almost $8 billion civil settlement last week. And yet companies have expanded deepwater drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. Once there's been a catastrophe like this, are the odds of a repeat actually smaller?
Generally speaking, they certainly should be, because especially when we're still close to the accident, relatively close. We're talking about a couple of years now. But as the settlement occurs and the accident becomes absent from the front page of the newspaper or even page 33, people forget. And not only ordinary people, but even people in the organizations that should be closer to the consequences of these accidents. Unfortunately, this seems to have been the case from the beginnings of recorded history, that accidents have always happened, but our memories seem to move pretty quickly away from them.
Here's a Titanic question from Richard in Bayside. Richard, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. I wanted to ask what Professor Petrosky's opinion is concerning evidence that spontaneous coal fires in the bunkers on the Titanic may have contributed to heating and thus weakening parts of the hull, which may have contributed to its sinking.
I don't think much of those. The damage that the iceberg did was in the bow sections of the ship, and it filled with water and began to dip. The breaking up of the ship that accompanied the sinking doesn't appear to have been due to excessive heat. It's usually just the opposite when things break in a brittle fashion, the way that appears to have done. It was the cold, the ambient cold weather that probably had more of a factor to play.
Deborah in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Oh, hey, how are you all?
All right.
Listening to the professor, it puts me in mind of, I grew up in spending a lot of time in the home of Charles Wesley Hammond, who was a nuclear engineer who worked for Babcock and Wilcox. And Mr. Hammond headed up the engineering team for the creation of the first nuclear fuel drive system that was used in submarines and then was adapted for Three Mile Island. And also he handled the international patent negotiations between Japan, the Japanese government, and the U.S. that gave birth to the Fukuyama fuel drive system. And when Three Mile Island happened, I remembered Mr. Hammond's martini intake at lunch quintupled, because what distressed him so was that it was not the design. It was sloppy human error that caused Three Mile Island, and he couldn't do a thing about it.
Thank you, Deborah, for the question. Did you look at Three Mile Island?
Yes, I'm a little bit familiar with it. I agree with the caller that it was not so much the design as the misinterpretation that operators gave to the design and how it was behaving.
As an engineer, how do you deal with the tremendous responsibility that goes along with designing something that could cause injury, whether it's a nuclear power plant or a new kind of cruise ship or whatever it is? Innovation is very exciting, but innovation brings new risks, sometimes deadly risks.
Well, that's right. That's a very good question. And engineers have thought about this for a very long time, and some of them have even written about it. They talk about lying awake at night, thinking about this design that they're working on and trying to figure out what could go wrong, literally keeping them awake.
One of the more bizarre examples that you write about is the faulty antenna design that caused an early edition of the iPhone 4 to drop calls when held a certain way. Apple knew about the problem but went ahead with the release of the flawed product anyway. Do you think they put design over functionality?
Well, I think that Steve Jobs had a very strong sense of design and belief in the way things looked. He himself was not an engineer. I think he may have thought that the engineers could always, you know, come up with the functionality requirements, but he was a very demanding person and didn't have a lot of patience, it appears. And I think in the case of the iPhone 4, it was more important to, you know, get it out to market than to perfect it, let's say.
And you actually write that humans could potentially completely prevent failure, but at the expense of all innovation and invention. I guess we have to assume that the benefits of innovation outweigh the risk of failure. But then again, it's very tempting to believe that, and maybe we need to look at it more on a case-by-case basis.
Well, that's right. Innovation, we hear that word a lot. And innovation means more than just changing technology. It really implies that there's a whole new way of life, so to speak, associated with the new technology. Inventions are different from innovations. We talk about we can have inventions galore without having necessarily any innovation. The goal of the invention is generally to improve the technology, not necessarily to change the way people deal with the technology.
We have about half a minute left. Are we still making the same mistakes that we did 5,000 years ago?
Unfortunately, I believe we are. We don't have any recorded history of, you know, the problems with the pyramids. We can only infer things. But we do have Vitruvius, who wrote about 2,000 years ago, and he describes mistakes, he describes errors and failures, and they sound awfully familiar, awfully modern.
Henry Petrosky teaches civil engineering and history at Duke University. His new book, To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure, it's now out. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And don't forget, Leonard Lopate coming up next, continuing his week of shows marking the Titanic centennial. Today, New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn shares stories of how her grandmother survived the doomed ocean liner.